In Vatican City, pallbearers, cardinals, and monks took Pope John Paul II on one last trip from his palace, escorting his body to St. Peter's Basilica, the church that was his for 26 years. The bier carrying the Pope, who had traveled the world during his papacy, began its short journey to the Vatican's Apostolic Palace, where he lived and ended it in the largest church in Christendom, where he will be buried on Friday. As the night fell over the tiny city state, the doors of the great basilica were thrown open, and tens of thousands of ordinary people started to flow in to pay their last respects to a man that some already are calling John Paul the Great. Many faithful had started from early morning to catch a glimpse of the pontiff, who was laid out in crimson and white vestments, and thousands more faced a long wait through the chilly night before their turn came to file past. "All my life he has been with me in the darkest moments. I would wait forever to see him," said 36-year-old Marcela Sogos, who flew from Sardinia for the occasion. And Mohammed Ali Agca, who shot and seriously wounded Pope John Paul II in 1981, said from his Turkish prison that he was mourning the death of his spiritual brother, and he wanted to attend the funeral. His lawyer said that he would put the request to prosecutors on Tuesday, but admitted that there was little chance that Turkey would allow a maximum security prisoner to attend the funeral of a man that he had shot. In a written statement in Italian, faxed to the Associated Press through his lawyers, Agca repeated his claim that he was the Messiah and that he was writing the true, perfect Bible. He signed off the letter, Mohammed Ali Agca, the Messiah servant. The wording of the letter suggested one more time that he may be unstable. And as President Bush prepares to lead the American delegation to the funeral for Pope John Paul II, he paid tribute Monday to the late pontiff, saying he appreciated the talks the two men had about the war in Iraq, admitting that the Pope's opposition to the war, even though they didn't agree on everything, he respected Pope John Paul II's perspective. By the way, you know, Friday night, Father Andrew Wingate had a prophecy. His prophecy was that this Pope would not die. So we put in a call to Father Wingate today to ask him what he thought of this failed prophecy. His words, basically, to producer Lisa Lyon, "I'll come on the show Tuesday. I'm sticking by my story." So we will be talking briefly tomorrow during our first hour with Father Andrew Wingate, who will continue to talk about that prophecy and why he's going to stick with that. Volunteers who have converged on the Mexican border around Arizona to watch for illegal immigrants are disrupting U.S. Border Patrol operations by apparently tripping sensors that alert the agents to possible intruders. Now, this is a very interesting story because these are participants in what is called the Minuteman Project. They are volunteers. They are trying to look for illegal aliens who are entering from Mexico through Arizona. Now, the Border Patrol opposes the operation, and they say the possibility for something going drastically wrong is very high. But quite frankly, something's got to be done about the illegal immigrants who continue to get into this country, because 1.1 million illegal immigrants caught by the Border Patrol last year, 51% crossed into the country at the Arizona border. Now, 1.1 million caught last year. How many got through? This is the Minuteman Project. You'll hear more about this on this program. Well, the price gouging of gasoline continues. The U.S. retail price for gasoline climbed to $2.22 a gallon. Did I say price gouging? Well, somebody tell me I'm wrong. Gasoline prices are up, they say, because of higher crude oil costs, which topped a record $58 a barrel on Monday. They say due to strong demand for motor fuel. It's just as strong as it's always been, but it wasn't this high before. Go to the coasttocoastam.com website. Look at the story under listener's email that Lex has posted. Now, it is a Friday, April Fool's story, but I did want you to see the picture. Wildlife officials are questioning a kayaker, they said, after a photo taken shows a very large unidentified creature in the lake right behind him. Again, it's an April Fool's story. It's not real, but that'll tell you the marvel of computer graphics and animation now. When you take a look at this Loch Ness-type monster right behind this kayaker. Looks like it's going to gobble him up. It's an incredible picture, and it's under listener's email on the coasttocoastam.com website. All kinds of things happen when you look, I guess. But let me tell you something. One man that I respect entirely is a person who has devoted a pretty good deal of his career now to the search for unidentified flying objects. For full disclosure, Dr. Stephen Greer will be our guest this hour in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Stephen Greer is the founder, CEO of Space Energy Access Systems, and also the founder and director of the Disclosure Project. He is an emergency physician, former chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Caldwell Memorial Hospital. He has appeared on several national programs, which include The Larry King Show, CBS, the BBC, NTV in Japan. Dr. Greer has been supervising a worldwide search for alternative energy sources, specifically those known as zero-point or over-unity devices, with the plan to identify and develop systems which will eliminate the need for fossil fuels. Now, you might remember some time ago that Peter Jennings had a special report on UFOs. Dr. Greer was able to provide a lot of information to ABC about that, but he's not too happy with the outcome. He's our guest this hour. Stephen, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Good. Very well indeed. Hey, I saw the letter that you wrote about the special, and I concur with you wholeheartedly. What I did not know was the depth that your organization, the Disclosure Project, provided, and it appears that they didn't use a lot of it, did they?
Well, it's very interesting. If you get to our website, disclosureproject.org, you'll see an analysis, about a five-page analysis of this. We were involved very early in this project with the Peter Jennings people, and what we found was that initially they wanted to do, quote, a historic event that would blow the lid off the secrecy. And when they found out that we had, in fact, over 400 military and government insiders, including generals and colonels and senior government officials, who were willing to go on the record on their program, they were very excited. What we found is as summer became fall, that the show sort of morphed into this public interest or human interest story, bringing in all kinds of spurious nonsense. And what's important, and I just want to correct you a little bit on this, not a single scrap of evidence provided to them, including all the 100-plus hours of top-secret military and government testimony that we have, was used. Not one
nothing?
Minute. Nothing. Nada. Zero. Now, what's interesting about that is that this is prima facie evidence that not only did they not want to do a serious piece, but they wanted to sanitize this of the strongest evidence. Keep in mind that Peter Jennings repeatedly said, well, the government isn't now looking into this subject since they closed Project Blue Book in 1969. We can prove that he knew that that is a lie. In fact, we gave him documents up into the 1990s even that were secret and top secret that describe projects and even give the project code names and code numbers. These are in Disclosure, the book we have of transcripts and government documents that people can get from us. They didn't have any of this in there. So I think that what's important, my main point, the reason I wrote this analysis and it's now making its way around the world, is that we're asking people to write the FCC, and they can get on our website, disclosureproject.org, and link to that and file a complaint. Because when a broadcast network that is using our airwaves under the permission of the United States people commits a hoax, and in this case, the title of my paper is Peter Jennings Defrauding. They defrauded the American people, and they committed a hoax, and we can prove it. We are now in discussions with some advisors who work with a very powerful attorney firm, and we're looking for some pro bono attorneys to actually take this to the FCC and take ABC to court and show that they rigged the news. They can edit things, and they can edit things for content, but they cannot, if they're going to claim that they're doing it through their news division, rig the news. And we can prove that they rigged the news story. And they sanitized this hard-hitting evidence from their program, even though they had a full 2 hours to present it. So I think that the American people who are listening to your show need to know that these large, big media operations are committing fraud, and we can prove it.
Stephen, you have spent several years now with this disclosure project, and as you say, you have come up with now close to 400 military insiders who aren't hiding. They're willing to come forward. They have come forward with the program that you had at the National Press Club several years ago.
Right.
To me, this would be a no-brainer to get these people on a major television show.
Well, of course, and in fact, when we had that press event, in fact, as recently as the last year or two, we've had discussions with these large news magazines, such as Primetime Live in 2020, where they wanted to do, in fact, the senior executive producer at the time of the Disclosure Project events, who's now back with 60 Minutes and Mike Wallace, but at the time he was the senior producer for 2020 and Primetime Live, wanted to do a full-hour expose of this. And after a few weeks, I called him. I said, what are you doing with this now? Because I gave him something like an edited version of 35 continuous hours of about over 100 of these top secret witnesses. And he was here at my home and said, I've never seen anything like this. It's amazing. He said, well, you know, they won't let me do it. I said, who's they? What are you talking about? He says, well, Dr. Greer, you know who they are, rather cryptically. Mm-hmm. And what I point out to people, you know, I don't like to quote copiously from government documents, but we received recently a secret CIA document that was briefly declassified. It was written in 1991, and it says, the Public Affairs Office, I'm quoting, now has relationships with reporters from every major wire service, newspaper, Newsweekly, and television network in the nation. This has helped us turn some intelligence failure stories into intelligence success stories. In many instances, we have persuaded reporters to postpone, change, hold, or even scrap or kill stories. Now, it's interesting, in light of what ABC set out to do and then what they ended up doing, how did that happen? And how is ABC News in essence, by putting forward something that they say is a fair and impartial review of the evidence, when we can prove that they did nothing of the sort, that they basically defrauded the American public, how were they influenced to do this? There is this shadowy entity that is running these covert programs. I'm glad you're having Catherine Austin Fitz on next, because she and I have spoken at great length about how this shadowy secret government transnational group works. But they have corrupted the government structures, and they have corrupted the Fourth Estate. And basically, people think we live in a democracy. We really live, I believe, in a kleptocracy, and the democracy part of what we live in is dying very slowly, and we need to resuscitate it.
You're absolutely right, Stephen. We have this perception that there's total freedom, but there is not. And I think more and more interviews with people like Catherine Austin Fitz and things that you uncover as well. I want to talk with you before you're off the air with me this hour about alternative energy, because that too is another scandal.
Oh, yes, there's some exciting things happening on that front as well.
I do have a sliver of some good, interesting news for you, because just today, apparently a group realized that you were going to be on the program tonight, and they called me about you, and I met with them, and you are most likely going to be approached in about 6 months for a different project for television, which I will give you full endorsement of their sincerity. They're going to go the other way.
Right.
They believe in the things you've done, and they've listened to Coast to Coast. They've listened to Art. They know what's going on. So I would guess it's going to probably take about 6 months. But you may see something that you will be very happy with providing information to these people, and they want you involved in a very big way. And like I say, it's about 6 months
away. We have offered to all these major news networks and other people everything we have. You know, I'm not being paid to do this, and we have been doing this for now 15 years collecting this kind of evidence. And what I tell people is that, hey, you know, it doesn't matter how many millions we put into getting this, I'll give it to you on a silver platter if you will only put the truth in front of the American public. ABC News wouldn't do it. They are a fraudulent news network.
But nobody's doing it, are they? Nobody's going out there.
One thing, if it's in their entertainment division and they do a funny ha-ha piece like ABC News did, it's another thing when ABC News claims that they are going to do a historic and accurate news story on the subject, and they take all this evidence and throw it in the trash bin and put all kinds of silly stuff showing a carnival atmosphere at Roswell and all the silly season of ufology. It was a complete takedown of the subject under the ruse of appearing to be fair and imbalanced, but it wasn't.
I called Stanton Friedman a promoter. He went nuts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course. I mean, and anyone who has evidence is a believer, whereas the scientists at Harvard are scientists. Well, I'm a scientist. My CEO, CTO, is a tenured professor of science at the University of New Hampshire and has been science advisors to public officials. It's, you know, but they spin it this way and then say, see, we did a fair and balanced piece. It was a cover-up piece, and it was very slick. And it's interesting that Disney, that owns ABC, we have a document from the early 50s where Disney was named as a source for putting cartoonish portrayals of flying saucers out into the public in this CIA document we have, which talks about psychological warfare operations. So, you know, the public needs to know this kind of fraud is going on and hold big media accountable. They need to write ABC News and they need to write the FCC, and we certainly encourage people to help support us in pursuing this through the FCC, because certainly ABC News, in our opinion, rigged this particular show in a way that is not allowed under FCC broadcast rules.
How did you, a doctor, years ago, get interested in the field of UFO study?
Well, there are two things when I was a little child that really got me hooked. One, when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I saw one of these objects, broad daylight, with some boys in the neighborhood where I grew up. And you're talking about North Carolina winning the basketball champion. Well, I grew up in North Carolina, in Charlotte. And I'm a North Carolinian, Tar Heel, and actually did a Chapel Hill residency. What's interesting is that that was at the same time that my mom's oldest brother was designing the lunar module. He was a senior project engineer with Grumman that built the thing that took Neil Armstrong to the moon. So I sort of was in this aerospace family at the same time I saw one of these things. And, of course, from then on, I was convinced that this was something to really take seriously and look into. And I did. In fact, even as a young child, I collected everything I could on the matter.
Stephen, personally, how do you feel about this UFO craze in the investigations of what they may be? I mean, there's no question people are seeing things. No question we're being visited from somewhere. Have you made a decision personally whether you think this is physical craft coming from other planets in the solar system, in this universe, or perhaps are they dimensional, coming from parallel universes? Have you come to any theories yourself?
Well, they're both, and this is the big debate I had with Jacques Vallée when we were doing something for Noetic Sciences a few years ago. People say, well, they're interdimensional, and I'll say yes, and they're also extraterrestrial and physical. Those are not two mutually exclusive things if you understand the full spectrum of nature and reality and how there are folded within every dimension access points to every other dimension. And in fact, when you go through interstellar space at multiples of the speed of light, you're dropping out of 3D material form and moving into a form that the mystics would have called it the astral or the sort of near physical. And this is what these are. They are extraterrestrial, but they are also transdimensional. They're both. And this is clearly the case from the evidence, but you have to have a comprehensive cosmology and physics understanding to get your mind around that. And this is one of the things I'm going to be giving a talk at Arizona State University on April 22nd in Phoenix. And one of the things we're going to go into in a whole day-long discussion is what the nature of these objects are and what it's telling us about reality, what it's telling us about the human future and technologies. And I think that, you know, the debate of whether or not they're interdimensional or extraterrestrial and physical is like saying, is an orange round or is it the color orange? Well, it's both. And I think that you get into these sort of dialectics and this either-or discussions, and the truth is somewhere between the two. And it's usually not either-or, but it's and.
All right, stay with us. A few months ago, Stephen, I had former Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell on, whom you know.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, I was just thrilled with what he said when I asked him if he thought we were being visited. And he says, evidence seems to prove that we have been.
Right.
And, you know, when you hear things, and again, you've talked to a lot of government whistleblowers and witnesses, but when you hear something from a person who walked on the moon that you have respect for, I mean, you just got to stop and say, you know, there's got to be something to this. And it's amazing that the skeptics are so convinced that there's nothing going on. I think one of their problems, they're looking at our technology today, and they can't figure out how we could go so many trillions and trillions of miles to get here. And they're not thinking of it in terms of, like you are, you know, going through different kinds of use of physics.
Well, I don't even think that they're that naive. Some of them are. Many of them are simply corrupt. I will remind people that the famous Condon report that closed Project Blue Book, we have documents from the CIA that were released to us after I briefed President Clinton's first CIA director, James Woolsey, that name Dr. Condon at the University of Colorado as a paid CIA operative. And so what you find, and if you look historically, same thing was true of Dr. Donald Menzel. We also have it on very good source that Carl Sagan was such a paid disinformation debunker. Many of these people are not just naive and don't understand the physics. They are actively on the payroll of some shadowy operation to go out there and make like honest scientists when they are actually, again, defrauding the American people.
You know, the FDA came out with a report, finally, because they were pushed, about some of their own researchers and people who have conducted studies of pharmaceuticals, and they found that a great many of them have been on the payroll of the pharmaceutical companies, or they've been consultants to the pharmaceutical companies, looking at, studying, and making reports to the FDA on the very drugs that these same companies are producing.
Correct.
A tremendous conflict of interest. And I would guess then that the same thing is true in the UFO field.
Right, and I think it's true in spades. And you have to wonder, I mean, can people like Seth Shostak at the SETI really be so dense that they can't look at the evidence? And, you know, they always say, well, where's the physical evidence? Well, there's only like 4,000 landing trace cases. You know, Admiral Lord Hill Norton and I talked about the physical evidence collected when one of these objects landed at Bentwaters up in England in the 1980s. There are thousands of cases like that. There's hard evidence. There's photographic evidence. There are radar tapes. They'll also say, well, where are all the radar? If these things were real objects, why aren't they on radar? The third highest ranking of person at the FAA during the Reagan years is one of our witnesses who took, when he retired, radar tapes that the CIA thought they had confiscated in a secret meeting with him that shows this UFO moving around this 747 over the skies of Alaska. I have this stuff. We tried to give it to Peter Jennings. We've given it to these other people. And you have to say, look, are you really that unable to digest data and read the King's English? Or are you really on someone's payroll? I mean, you know, these people can't be that dumb.
Friend of mine who used to be a reporter for a local station in St. Louis years ago was called out to Ellsbury, Missouri on a UFO situation where residents there saw all kinds of lights and possible landings. The
right.
Next morning, Stephen, there was a huge round circle burned out. Cows were walking around it, and there was a dead cow right in the middle.
Right.
And then he told me one thing that I'll never forget. He said, George, I saw a tree near this, what I thought was a landing spot. The whole side of it was scorched as if some flame had hit it. And etched in and burned into the tree must have been thousands and thousands of dead flies.
Hmm.
Now, you know, this just doesn't happen naturally.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's so many cases like this, and this is one of the problems, is that you know, they'll say all their theories. I said, well, can you give me a piece of a black hole?
Yeah.
Never measured a black hole.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that I can't flop a dead ET on the table for them, they'll say, well, see, they don't exist. I'm going, this is ridiculous. It's a double standard, and it's not real science. It's junk science. There's plenty of good science to support this. But one point you make is important in terms of the paradigm. I think that we have to begin to look at this not so anthropocentrically. And what I mean by that is that this is 21st century Earth. If we're dealing with civilizations that are hundreds of thousands or millions of years technologically more developed than we are, every manifestation of their technology would look magical to us, just as if we went back 5,000 years and showed primitive tribes, people, cell phones, and flashlights. I think that we have to understand that the technology isn't at its apex on planet Earth as it can be represented throughout the universe, and that the ability to make the universe, physical universe, very small through the ability of what I call this sort of phase transition from the three-dimensional material object into these, what some people would call interdimensional. I don't call them that. I call them a finer fabric of the structure of reality that it can be accessed. And I think that this is what we're observing. And in fact, many of the military people I've dealt with have seen solid materialized objects that then morph into something that looks almost like a energetic plasma, almost like a ghost, and then it moves off slowly and then vanishes
then
into
it's gone.
Space. So, you know, you have these things that are obviously three-dimensional material morphing over into these other forms of energy and stuff that we haven't quite quantified except in our covert programs. Now, it's also important to understand that we have witnesses who were as far back as the 1950s were in facilities run by U.S. and Canadian governments. That had been the ability, it sounds like Star Trek, where they were able to literally, quote, dematerialize a solid object and have it reappear in another room under controlled electronic systems in 1953. I was not a twinkle in my father's eye at that point. So, you know, you hear this sort of thing from more than one very credible military or ex-military guy, and, you know, you have to go, there's a lot of stuff going on out there and that we have. And this brings up this other question. If we have these sort of experiments that have been going on for over 50 or 60 years, why are we still burning oil and coal? And why are we destroying our biosphere? And why are we in oil war number whatever in Iraq? I mean, the whole situation on this planet is an artificial contrivance by people who want to keep a centralized transnational lock on the power system. It has nothing to do with what is extant within these classified projects. And I think it's very important for your listeners to understand that even though what we're doing at SEAS, the sort of energy startup research group we're doing, is primitive by comparison, we have to begin to say, look, isn't it time for us to say, if these guys won't let this stuff out of a black box, don't we need to pull it together, pull our resources together, find the scientists who are out there, and begin to make our own versions of these things?
I
think we can do it. I think we can, and we must.
I'm beginning to see the picture of the dots connected by you, which it took me a long time to see, quite frankly, Stephen,
right.
Because I couldn't understand why there wasn't disclosure. You know, I couldn't understand what's the big deal. Just come and tell us we've been visited. We've been visited since the beginning of this planet,
right.
And there's life out there, and everything's great, and let's go find them, and let's build spaceships. And then all of a sudden, you started talking about alternative energy, and it dawned on me that if they disclosed that they know about these craft or these forms of energy that they've used in order to get here,
right.
Then the American people and this world would start saying, well, why don't you create it for us?
Sure.
And that's where the big oil companies and these other organizations that are just continuing to sap us, that's where they have the problem. So
right.
I think,
and, you know, and interestingly, Thomas Jefferson, who's buried right down the road from my home here, I live right near Monticello in Virginia, said and warned that when the United States was first being founded, that the unchecked powers of large corporations could destroy our democracy. And I think that I am not anti-corporate or anti-business at all. I am anti-corruption, however. And I think what Catherine Austin Fitz will talk about, if you ask her, is that we're really talking about the world's largest RICO, racketeering influence corrupt organization, and it's in our government, and it's in corporate, and it's in financial sectors, and it is, of course, damaging our society greatly, not to mention our biosphere.
Well, here we are with oil now at around $58 a barrel, and they say because there's an increased demand. Come on. I mean, you know, we're using oil and we shouldn't. But the point is, are we using, Stephen, that much more to push it up to $58 a barrel where it was around 30-something a year ago?
Well, I think all these markets are manipulated, although there are some fundamentals that are real, and that is, for example, China moving into the commodities markets, whether it's oil or steel or copper or cement. I think you have pressures, and I think this is why all the way back in the early 90s, when we first started having discussions with people like Lawrence Rockefeller and President Clinton's people, is that we said, look, you know, this is a freight train headed down our direction. We have got to anticipate it, make some changes, and bring this stuff out. But no one had the courage to do it. And I think that what we have concluded over the last decade is that we, the people, are going to have to form our own energy research effort and bring this out. We're going to have to do our own disclosure. The government is not going to do it for us, or if they do, it'll be too damn late. And I think that we have to take responsibility for this. This is why I gave up my medical career to pursue these things. And I think that we really have to take responsibility for our planet and our future and create the good future that is possible for us. It isn't going to be done by itself.
Let's talk a little bit about why we can't have an energy XPRIZE. I mean, already now we're getting the privatization of space. It works.
Right.
Bert Rutan
right.
is doing his thing. Why can't we do the same thing for energy?
Well, I think we probably could. The problem is that, A, who's going to fund it, and, B, who's going to support and protect the inventors who work on this? I think that, for example, we have identified at SEAS at least a dozen solid proof-of-principle technologies. And one of them, for example, derives hydrogen very inexpensively from water and a few catalysts so that you could have free hydrogen out of water. And we're not talking electrolysis or anything expensive. But these are things that are in their early stages. They need to be developed further. There's really no funding for that. We have funded what we've done really out of the back pockets of a handful of our people. And the question is, you know, the billions of dollars going into from the public coffers into coal and oil and hydrogen research, why isn't any of it really going into this new energy field of advanced electromagnetic generators, electrogravitic systems? I know a man right now who has a very well-developed mathematical and physical proof-of-principle model for anti-gravity, but we're having a hard time finding anyone to put the funds up to bring it to the next stage of development. So what I'm saying to people is that these things exist, but who's going to fund it? When you end up, I've met with people, for example, in Senator Byrd's office and other offices, even in the last year or so, and what they'll say is, well, you know, if it would rock the boat too much, I'm not sure that the senator would want to pursue that. Of course, it would replace the need for coal.
Exactly.
Or if you're from an oil state, oil. So I think that, you know, it's going to take people coming together, realizing that we have to pool our resources and our research. And I will still say, if there's someone sitting out there in their basement or garage with something that genuinely is creating a lot of zero-point energy, and I don't mean milliwatts, but hundreds of watts to a kilowatt or two, and they want to see that get out to the public, our group can do it. But we're still searching for that the one that is that far along. The ones that we have seen are not far enough along to, I think, win what you would call an X Prize. Actually, for a while, we had something called the Z Prize for this same purpose. But none of the things we found met that criteria, except things that had already been corrupted and suppressed. You know, Dr. Beard and I talked extensively about this. There were things such as the Kauai motor and other things that existed in the 80s. And the corrupt enterprises bought them up, shelved them, threatened the inventors, and took them out of public circulation. So, you know, we're going to need to pull our resources and also stand together in a united front to get these things out there.
Toshiba last week announced that for a hybrid engine for car, they have now invented a new lithium battery that recharges in minutes instead of hours, and they think that's going to revolutionize things. At least there are some companies out there going in the right direction, aren't there?
Yes, there are, and in fact, there are some inventors we're dealing with. I mentioned this hydrogen development, and I think this gentleman who's the inventor sent you an email that he copied to me tonight. I don't know if you read it. But what's interesting is that there are significant potential breakthroughs that are on the horizon. The question is, what will happen to them? If there isn't large financial or government support, what we're going to have to do is put them on coast to coast or put them out in front of sure. 5 or 10 or 15 million people and say, all right, now you guys need to support this. And I don't know if we have to do an ITO or what we do, but we're going to have to say the people are going to have to support it. I'm very skeptical that large corporations like General Motors or Exxon or the U.S. government are actually ever going to do anything meaningful on this issue.
Well, one of the reasons
they have to step on too many of their own toes to do it.
I don't know what your take is on peak oil, Stephen, but I don't believe it. I think it's contrived. I think the oil companies are trying to create fear that we're running out of oil, therefore they got to do what they got to do. I think this planet probably has an abundance of oil, unfortunately, in it that could last thousands of years.
Yes, it could last thousands of years being used for something other than energy. The problem is, and I'll tell you, I never have talked about this before. I have met with folks within that sector dealing with intelligence, and what you said is true. There's a lot more oil than people think. But if we use it at the rate we're going to need to use it to let the whole our whole 6 billion people civilization advance, the damage to the biosphere would be 10 times worse than what we're seeing
sure.
now. It's an exponential decay.
Of course,
what's happening already in China, we have huge dust clouds and smoke clouds in the Pacific Northwest because of the smokestack
yeah.
junk coming out of China. So, you know, the planet is a small place when push comes to shove. And even if you could pump all this stuff out of the oil, out of the ground and burn it at the rate that we could and keep it cheap and plentiful, what's going to happen to Antarctica? What's going to happen to our biosphere? I think that, and yet, they also don't want to bring out these alternatives because once they're out of the box, they're going to take off very quickly, just like the internet and computers and PCs and cell phones did. These sort of technologies, once they get some legs, man, they're going to run. And then it's goodbye oil, goodbye coal, goodbye centralized economies, because when you can generate free energy from the zero-point field out of your own house, for manufacturing, clean water, electricity, transportation, it would be a whole new world.
Yep, about
different world.
A little more than a week ago, I was in Hawaii for a show and then a speech, and then I was back home again. It all took about 2.5 days.
Right.
And I got there, Stephen, and I went, that's it? That's the trip? And, you know, and it's felt like, you know, it does on a map, it looks like it's halfway around the world. And you're right, it's a small planet. And
oh, yeah.
So what if these 6 billion people are reduced to 500 million? Then they have something.
Right. And I think there are folks who have this sort of eschatological solution to the human problem. I'm sort of putting the Third Reich word phraseology here. But there's some really strange character out there who are out there in this power structure that Catherine Austin Fitz and I and others have uncovered. But I think that what we also have to see is there's some very good people. You know, I'm reminded of Monsignor Balducci when I was interviewing him overlooking St. Peter's Basilica. And after I interviewed him and he was talking very affirmatively about the fact that there is life in the universe and we're all children of God and had a very positive take on all of this, off camera he pulled me aside and he says, you know, Dr. Greer, I could not be saying this to you unless Papa, referring to the Pope that just passed away, wanted me to tell you.
That's
this.
Absolutely true. Stephen, you're
very
always
interesting story.
You're always welcome on Coast to Coast, my friend.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you.
Two websites, disclosureproject.org, SEAS, SEAS, SEASpower.com. They're both linked up with Dr. Stephen Greer's name under tonight's guest on Coast to Coast AM.